Case Finji versus Feld, 041056.
Your Honor, if I could volunteer, I just need counsel to Dr. Finji. I'll be with you.
That would be great. Mr. Dacus, are you ready to proceed? All right.
If it pleases the court, my name is John Sudeikis. I represent the appellant, Dr. Paul Finji, in this matter. We request the court reverse the judgment of the district court for the reasons set forth in our brief. Today I'm only going to address 2 points in support of our position, and we'll rely on our brief for the other points. The first point I want to address is whether or not the district court erred in entering summary judgment against the plaintiff. I know that I don't have to state the standard, but it appears from what the district court did, I might have to. In passing on a motion for summary judgment, the trial court has only a very limited duty. It's to determine whether or not a genuine issue of material fact exists. It is not allowed to resolve that dispute. Once it finds that a genuine issue of material fact exists, that's the end of where it can go at that point. It cannot make credibility determinations. It cannot weigh evidence that is presented to it. I want to just give you one example of what I thought was the most obvious example where the trial court made an error. We had...
You know what? You need to stay near the at the podium so we can record it. If you want to move your chart over, you can.
Thank you.
Your Honor, can I request the opportunity to see what he's showing?
Yes.
Walk right up to it.
Right.
Walk right up.
Or if Your Honor would like, I can give him a small copy of the
exhibit that I have. That would be very helpful.
How small is it?
It's
might need a magnifying glass.
I'm afraid I need to read from this as well, Your Honor. I apologize, I didn't make contact.
That's a good trick.
Early on in the proceedings, we moved for a preliminary injunction. And a genuine issue of material fact in this case is whether or not the plaintiff actually requested a hearing from the university. We submitted that he did. The defendants say that he did not. When we moved for a preliminary injunction, the district court entered the order on May 28, 2002. It states in the May 28, 2002 order, and I'm looking at page 9, footnote 10, defendant provides an August 10, 2000 letter from the plaintiff in which plaintiff states, quote, I respectfully ask that a complete and sufficient inquiry into this be done. It concludes that could be that written request could be construed as a request for a hearing.
How do you construe that as a request for hearing?
The district court found that, though, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And here's what happens when they move for summary judgment. It reverses itself 180 degrees. It took what essentially was the law of the case at that time and said, no, now we're going to say this isn't a written request for a hearing. If you look at the December 8th order, it says, well, this isn't a request for a hearing. It asks for an inquiry. Well, an inquiry could be a hearing. It could not be a hearing. He didn't follow up with this request. Therefore, we don't understand this as a request for a hearing. District Court oversteps its bounds at that point, doesn't it? It cannot resolve this issue. If, in fact, it could be construed as a hearing, then guess what? We get a trial on that matter. The District Court is here for summary judgment only. If it finds a genuine issue of material fact, that's the end of the line right there. It has to make a determination at that point that this issue goes to trial. The other point is this. May 28, 2002, when the district court enters the order for a preliminary injunction, it does not have to construe all inferences in the favor of the plaintiff, does it? That's not the standard for a preliminary injunction. In fact, we had the standard to prove, which was a fairly high burden, for it to grant a preliminary injunction. However, on December 8, 2003, when it was faced with a motion for summary judgment, it was obligated at that point to construe every inference in favor of the plaintiff, which it clearly did not. I'll give you another example, if I may, of how the district court erred in this motion for...
Thomas, why did you omit the error program in your resume?
Your Honor, it is not clear at this point, and whether or not that was an error. And if I can get to my second point, Your Honor, I think this will point it out.
That's rather key.
The district court found that included in the plaintiff's application process to the university was a curriculum vitae. That really is the whole heart of their argument. Somehow, the plaintiff misled this person into accepting him into the university. The plaintiff's contention is, look, I never submitted a curriculum vitae to the University of Illinois as part of the application process. I don't know how they got a copy of that curriculum vitae. I don't know how they got a copy of this letter. It was our contention that perhaps in discovery, when they asked us to produce all documents relating to any applications, we produced it to them, and they used this and said, well, this was submitted to the university. It was not. If your honors will take a look at these exhibits, you'll find something very striking about them. One is that the dates are completely wrong, if in fact this was an application to the university. The date on the application on the CV, and it looks like it's written in the European style, 3/17/2000 it should be, is March 17, 2000. The application, the date on the actual application that's submitted to the university is June 8 of 2000, some 3 months later. We ask, how can this be submitted with the application when it's dated 3 months in advance? The other question you have to ask yourself is, if that was his application to the university, why did he need to fill out another one as well? He wouldn't have to at that point, would he? It's our contention, and it's equally plausible, that we did not submit that CV as part of the application process to the university.
Counsel, even assuming factual disputes on the points that you're identifying here today and the points that you identified in your brief, isn't it undisputed that your client was given an opportunity to identify anything unfavorable or that might reflect unfavorably on his application for this residency program? He responded to that both in the interview with the residency director and in an email afterwards, indicating that there was no such unfavorable information that to offer that would reflect unfavorably on his candidacy for this residency program, when in fact there was, because he had been discharged for grounds of questionable competence from a residency program.
Your
in
Honor,
Europe.
I don't think
all of that is undisputed. All of that was offered as a justification for his termination from this program, and the discharge, therefore, the termination can correctly, as the district court concluded, be characterized as academic in nature, and your due process claim fails as a matter of law.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. First of all, the record isn't developed as to actually what happened at that interview. He denies that anything of that sort happened where he was asked specifically, did you have a problem in any sort of residency programs as well?
No. But you're mischaracterizing what I said and what the testimony, the undisputed evidence is, that he was offered an opportunity to identify anything unfavorable in his background. I think the terminology was skeletons in his closet that would reflect poorly on his application for the residency program, and he responded that there wasn't anything of that nature in his background, and then he followed that up unilaterally by sending an email reinforcing that, when in fact he knew that he had previously been discharged from a residency program in Europe on grounds of questionable competence.
Your Honor, he's a Canadian citizen. It's my understanding that the word skeletons in their closet was not clear to him at the point. And when he asked for, what do you mean, he was asked, well, are you ever convicted of some sort of crime? And he stated no. If you look at the application itself that's up there, there is a reference put down in that application for somebody at Air Hospital where this purported incident took place. If he, in fact, is trying to defraud the director of admissions, he's the stupidest person I know. He puts down a reference from the person who's at that residency program. There are 10 instances in the record where he discloses, I was at Air Hospital. There's the application itself. There's a work history that was submitted to the university. There are 8 letters of reference from doctors at Air Hospital. If Dr. Fowle had done what he was supposed to do and investigated, how could he ever say I was defrauded? He had all of this information before him, before Dr. Fenge even came for the interview, before his termination, and reportedly he took no action on it. The law in Illinois is, if you have the opportunity to investigate and you don't, you can't claim that you've been defrauded. There's no doubt in the record that he had 10 instances from letters of reference to the application itself. Well, he could have called somebody over at Air Hospital, and he did not. The only thing that he stated is somehow he got an anonymous letter after the fact. Well, that's not good enough. The other thing is this, Your Honor, and I disagree with you on this being an academic versus a disciplinary decision. The Board of Carolinas versus Horowitz, I think, is the controlling authority on this. And I will quote from them. They said, how do you determine whether something is disciplinary or academic? They said the determination whether to dismiss a student for academic reasons requires an expert evaluation of cumulative information, not readily adapted to the procedural tools of judicial or administrative decision-making. What sort of expert analysis do you need to say whether or not this person did or did not disclose something in an application? We're not arguing he should have gotten a C in oncology, and he got a D in pharmacology, well, that was wrong. If I came to this court, you'd say, look, we're not experts on something like that. We can't make a determination. You don't have to defer to the administrators on this case. This is a case where you have just as much insight into this as they do. I cited this court to multiple cases in my brief stating that this is, in fact, a disciplinary decision. Roach versus University of Virginia was right on point where the same exact thing happened, and they said, look, it's undisputed that this is a disciplinary decision.
This is the docus. You're in your rebuttal time.
I will take it all if I may, Your Honor.
All right.
The other thing is this, Your Honor. If, in fact, this is an academic decision, like the defendant contends, you don't need to give him a hearing then, do you? But why did they give him one? They could have said, look, this is an academic decision. We don't have to give you a hearing. They've essentially admitted, haven't they, by giving him a hearing that this was a disciplinary decision.
So then in your brief, when you make reference to purported hearings that he received, you're conceding now that he did receive a hearing.
He received some sort of hearing, Your Honor. I wasn't allowed to be there. We've made numerous evidentiary objections to this proceeding as well.
But it was within keeping with his procedural rights as defined under the residency agreement.
We don't agree with that, Your Honor. If you look at...
Who do you agree with?
We agree... if I may just change the page. This is Exhibit B. These are the procedural rights that he has. And Bowen versus Barchi, which isn't an often cited Supreme Court case for some reason, states that you can have a constitutional violation either on its face or as applied. And they looked at a case where a New York trainer for horses was discharged, and they said the procedure for discharging him on its face and as applied was unconstitutional. If you look at Exhibit B, there is no time period in which the university has to offer a hearing to the plaintiff. Let's not remember who has the burden of proof here as well. They're taking a property interest away from them. That's undisputed. The state has the burden of coming forward and providing a hearing with them.
I don't think the issue of property, the property interest is undisputed. I think it was disputed in the district court and at least maintained as an argument here, if not fully developed.
I think the district court, though, in its findings, rightly stated that he does have a property interest. I think the more important thing is one of timing, Your Honor. Here, it was over 2 years in which he was offered a hearing. Let's not kid ourselves here. He had to file a lawsuit to get them to offer him a hearing. Not only that, but they admitted, and if you look at Dr. Fowle's affidavit, they admitted that they couldn't take this person back in the program even if he prevailed at the hearing.
Why did you wait 2 years to make that formal request?
I can't answer that at this time, Your Honor.
Why?
Well, first of all, it's our contention that we, in fact, the plaintiff, in fact, demanded a hearing by providing that letter to him, and he wasn't provided with such. Should he have followed up more?
When did you make the formal request? After 2 years, isn't that true?
No, that is absolutely not true. There was a letter that was sent right after his termination to the head of the anesthesiology department where he said, give me a hearing. They did not provide him with one. It wasn't until 2 years later when
we
filed.
Do you have a copy of that in the file?
There is a copy of that in the record, Your Honor. And that was the first exhibit that we showed you, and the district court agreed with us, first of all, saying, well, that's a good request for a hearing. There's no magic words. We request a hearing. It says, we do have something to be done. Have an inquiry.
They requested an inquiry, didn't it?
Your Honor,
couldn't an inquiry, isn't that usually interpreted as an inquiry on the part of the university authorities?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
I know you don't agree, but, I mean, isn't that usually the accepted meaning of an inquiry?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. If, in fact, this person who is not a lawyer, who is not a layman, who doesn't know the procedures that are to be used at a university, the burden is on the university to come forward, Your Honor. I don't agree that, in fact, oh, the plaintiff didn't offer a hearing, well, we didn't have to give him one. Is that the law that we want to put for the universities? You know, if he doesn't demand a hearing, we don't have to give him one. And, you know, let's wait 2 years and see. We'll string him along a little bit. Maybe we'll get past the statute of limitations problem. And by that time, maybe our academic standards are changed. Maybe at this point, this person's a doctor. He hasn't been practicing his skills. We can't take him back into the program anyway. Then we just throw up our hands and we say, you know what? Even if you prevail at a hearing, we can't put you back in the program anyway. That's what happens here. And that's their argument. They want the proverbial free good. They said, look, the only remedy you could give this person at this time is give him a hearing. Well, that's great, but you've admitted that even if he prevails at a hearing, he's not getting back into the program. There's a problem with that sort of argument, Your Honor. They're going to use this free good until the marginal benefit from doing so is zero. Isn't that axiomatic? They're going to use it until they use it, until somebody says, no, that's not right. Barry versus Barchi saw the injustice of this. It said, look, you want to take care and give this person a hearing, it has to be prompt. Admittedly, they didn't say 5 days, they didn't say 10 days, they said prompt. And it depends on a case-by-case analysis. What is prompt about a two-year delay?
I'll let you finish your thought, but your time is up.
Your Honor, there's nothing prompt about a two-year delay. The rule that this court needs to set down is, look, you take a property interest away from somebody, he was not even afforded a pre-termination hearing, you need to give this person a prompt post-deprivation hearing. And the only remedy, you can't come into court and then state, well, the only remedy that he has is to give him a hearing 2 years after the fact, especially when you've admitted that, even if this person prevails at a hearing, he ain't getting back into the program anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jadola? And will you need this chart, Tom?
No, I'd prefer if it wasn't here. Thank you, Counsel. Chief Justice Williams, Counsel, Mr. Zedakis, may it please the Court.
I'm not Rehnquist, Counsel. And my Justice Williams is just fine. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Norman Judlow. I represent Dr. Feld. In his reply, Dr. Fenge argues that policy considerations support university liability, claiming in effect that a ruling for Dr. Feld by this court would in some way support a violation of the 14th Amendment. What Dr. Fenge fails to recognize is that this case is unique, and it's unique for at least three reasons. The first one is that under the resident agreement that counsel showed you in that chart, Dr. Fenge did have the right to request a hearing any time. He knew, according to the record, that he was terminated at least in September of 2000. That's what the record says. Judge Hart determined and said there was nothing that was keeping him from requesting a hearing then. He just didn't comply with the procedure. Seen in this case, in this light, this case is not about the university's willful refusal to provide a hearing or anything like that. This case is about whether or not there is a constitutional violation because the university did not provide a notice that was required by the residency agreement setting forth the terms and conditions forming the basis for the termination.
And why wasn't he provided with prompt written notice advising him of his right to a hearing as required by the residency agreement?
Well, actually, Your Honor, that's the second reason why this case was unique. It's undisputed, and Dr. Feld has said it on many occasions in the record, that he didn't know the resident agreement had been signed. He didn't know that there were any formalities that had been accomplished, and so he was unaware that formalities would be required to terminate the agreement. He also said that if he'd have known that Dr. Fenge had some claim to a hearing, he would have certainly seen that he got one.
Well, what about the letter that Finji sent asking for the inquiry to be made?
Well, he certainly did ask for an inquiry. I would agree with the question in this regard. An inquiry means that a request is being made to the receiver of the letter saying, would you look into this? That's vastly different than requesting a hearing. And he had the residency agreement. It said request a hearing in writing. He didn't use those words. He asked Judge Dr. Albrecht to do something, and Dr. Albrecht did it. The third reason that this case is unique is because it concerns an applicant for a residency training who admittedly, in writing, it's in writing, it's not denied, did not disclose the fact that he had a significant problem at Air Hospital when he was requested to do so. And then he, as the judge followed up with that question, he did not, he volunteered that information again in an email. At all the same time, he was actually actively engaged in litigation with that residency program, challenging the outcome. So this presents a case where the individual was not inadvertent in his non-disclosure. He actively sought to deceive as to the information.
So I take it that would be your response to counsel's position that since he was Canadian, he didn't understand what skeletons in the closet meant.
Well, I don't know if Canadian has anything to do with it. What I do know, Your Honor, is that there is nothing in the record that said that he didn't understand. And the email quite specifically used those terms. I would assume that if, and I think it can be inferred, that if someone uses the term themselves, they know what they're using and what they're saying. But that information is not in the record. That wouldn't be a basis upon which Judge Hart would have decided anything. The other thing that Dr. Finji does in his reply is raise a whole plethora of issues about discovery. He says the district court erred because it didn't give him inquiry into other residency training programs throughout the University of Illinois and throughout the state of Illinois. Judge Hart found that those requests were overly broad, and in fact they were very broad. They asked for any information about any terminated resident, no matter what the basis for the termination was, arguably even a termination because the resident successfully completed the training program. But it's important to note that Judge Hart made his decision not based upon any objections that Dr. Feld made, but rather on the way that the requests were drafted. Dr. Finji also claims that he did not receive a wide variety of documents. It's dead wrong to say that's the case. In accordance with arguments made in Dr. Feld's response to Dr. Fenji's motion to compel at R61, he received every document that was relevant arising out of the anesthesiology program. There was nothing that he was deprived of, including information about other residents who were terminated and residents who might have received a hearing. In neither case, there were none. There were no volumes of information that were shielded by some action of the district court. Dr. Finji was entitled and did receive anything in his file about his application. That was not denied. All Dr. Feld said is, we'll turn over, and this is response to interrogatory number 14, we'll turn over whatever there is in our files. Dr. Finji even tries to claim that he was deprived of information because of Dr. Feld's standard response, which was that he would turn over non-privileged documents. The only thing Dr. Feld did not turn over are a few of those privileged documents that would obviously not be available. But more importantly, under this court's previous decisions, it will not reverse a grant of summary judgment based upon a discovery error, even if it was made, unless a party can show, quote, clear, that there was clear and substantial actual prejudice to the complaining litigant. And that's Gall versus United Airlines at 95 Fed 3rd 49 and other cases. Dr. Finji has not successfully set forth a basis to show that there was clear and substantial prejudice. Turning then to the actual case itself, Dr. Finji has raised four factual questions that he says preclude summary judgment. Probably the most important is what he talked about when he argued before your honors, and that's the question of whether or not he requested a hearing. He did submit a couple of conclusory affidavits that said that he did request a hearing, but Judge Hart found that those were too conclusory to ever serve as a basis to refute the clear affidavits provided by Dr. Albrecht and Dr. Feld. But even more importantly, the question about whether he requested a hearing as such is not relevant to the determination of this case. It's not relevant because this was essentially an academic decision, as Judge Hart found. Therefore, whether he requested a hearing would not be relevant. It was also not relevant to whether or how this two-year delay occurred in receiving the post-termination hearing, because, again, the judge made his decision based upon the fact that Dr. Finge could not show that there would have been a difference in the outcome of the case had the hearing occurred more rapidly. So, therefore, there would be no basis for damages on that regard. Dr. Finge also claims that Dr. Feld's motive was in question. Well, there was no dispute about this. Dr. Feld acted for one reason and one reason only, and that was because Dr. Finge was not candid with him. That was quite clear. And also, there's no dispute that Dr. Feld did not provide the process because he didn't know the contract had been signed. And by and large, Dr. Finge's claims do not depend on a showing of motive. His due process claim doesn't have anything to do with motive, but the only arguable basis upon which Dr. Finge might have a motive issue has to do with his vindictiveness 14th Amendment claim. There, Dr. Finge has pleaded himself out of a case because in his second amended complaint, and I believe it's paragraph 37, he admits that the motive here was only that Dr. Finge was not candid. As the district court found, that's clearly insufficient evidence of vindictiveness to justify a class of one denial of equal protection. For these reasons, Judge Hart correctly found that summary judgment properly should be brought in favor of Dr. Feld. This case is like this court's previous decision in Martin versus Helfstead. In that case, the student, it was an applicant for law school there, received some informal give and take before the decision was made and the opportunity to explain the decision as contemplated by Goss versus Lopez. This case is also like Martin versus Helfstead because in Martin, as in this case, Dr. Finge has admitted in writing that he did not disclose the air hospital problem when he was directly asked to do so by Dr. Feld. This gives rise to a separate basis as to why no post-deprivation process, why no further process, would be required. The issue is clearly defined and well documented within the concept of Matthews versus Eldridge, meaning that further process wouldn't have helped to explain the issue. An oral hearing would have done nothing to advance the factual record that was not already advanced by the informal give and take. Judge Hart also correctly found that there was no issue that arose out of the two-year delay. First, he couldn't determine which party was responsible for the delay based on the record before him. But then Judge Hart further found that this would not be a basis for any form of reinstatement because Dr. Finge couldn't say the outcome of the hearing would have been any different had it occurred more rapidly. He also found that that was not a basis for compensatory damages for the same reason. As to the emotional damages claim, Judge Hart found that there was insufficient tie-up between the one conclusory affidavit statement about emotional damages and anything relating to this case, and certainly the emotional damages claim was not supported with the specificity required by this court in numerous decisions. Judge Hart also correctly determined that as to nominal damages, there was no basis to hold Dr. Feld responsible because it was Dr. Albrecht's responsibility to see that the hearing was held, and that's in fact what the record shows. In effect, Dr. Fengi sued the wrong individual if he wanted nominal damages. That particular decision of the district court has not been challenged on appeal and therefore must be held as good. For all these reasons, Dr. Feld urges this court to affirm the decision of Judge Hart granting summary judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And your time is up, Mr. Zadakis. We'll take this case under advisement and call the next